We continue our discussion with Bob Pelfrey with a special guest who just happened to be a former student of his. Stay tuned. Hi there. I am Stephen DeLuque, and, along with Krissa Hewitt, the producers and hosts of this program, Ears on Art, which is a segment of Issues and Ideas, produced at the studios of listener-supported public radio station KCBX, serving the Central California coast from Salinas to Ventura. Krissa and I present the second half of our conversation with one of the founding fathers of the art curriculum at Cuesta College, Bob Pelfrey. As part of the 50th anniversary celebration at Cuesta College, the three founders, Chet Amix, Barry France, and Bob Pelfrey, were honored with solo shows. More about that later. Now, to Bob with a visit from one of his former students.
That can't be Guy, right? You've made it!
I made it!
Talking about the early days, and Guy, you were not that bald then.
I had less hair.
I had black hair like a rock star.
Reminded me of one, too.
Guy Rathbun's part in this story will become evident very shortly, but we are going to begin where we left off last week, with Bob discussing how his dreams play such an important role in his artwork.
I mean, I see my art as really an extension of a process. For me, my instant dreams originated in a kind of therapeutic mode, life crisis thing. So art, for me, if anything, catching the stream of life is not so much a composition as that gives you, if you were fishing or if you were at a river, that was the weather, that was how the flow of my life was at that time. So the stylistic thing is not particularly consistent. I have a few very realistic things, and I have some that are very expressionistic. But the main energy comes from the dream journal that I keep on a regular basis.
I'm not sure that we've had too many people on this show for all these years talk about creating things and ripping them up.
I do a lot of drawing, which fortunately you can store a lot of it because I don't exhibit. I'm just not a good businessman. And I'm not interested in doing the hard work it takes to try to get some gallery. I would love to do it. I'm just not good at it. And so why do I do it? I do this because it is, if anything, a kind of yoga for me, doing art. It's fine with me if I spend all day drawing and it sucks. I just rip it up. And I don't have this huge investment and responsibility, say, I have to have a show next year. That's the payoff for being a teacher. And I don't have to depend on exhibiting or selling my work. So it may sound a little bit self or narcissistic to somebody hearing that, but it's the opposite in many ways. It means that somebody who really love to play tennis or something, and it's hugely meaningful to their life. They don't expect people to pay money to come watch them. I don't see my art as something that I have to show. I do it, and then if I have a chance to show it, I'm delighted. Most of my art also isn't stuff people want to put in their living rooms, you know, because it's my dream. Since I insist on working with my dream, I have to live with the consequences of that, and that is, it would take a very specialized, say, gallery that would have clients who would be interested in looking at images that become so subjective. In other words, I'm very happy doing the art that I do.
We've discussed this with a couple of artists and the fact that it's the process that's important.
Yes.
And it's the product that is exactly. Not as important. And it's part of the journey as an artist is that this is how we express ourselves. This is part of our conversation with the world. Yeah. And for me anyway, once the image is down, I don't have much interest in it because I've learned what I had to do by creating the image. And after that, it's like I don't consider it precious at that point. And if somebody else appreciates it, fine. But that's not my primary goal.
You said it better and more succinctly than I just tried to do, right? That's exactly what I meant. So thank you. Yeah, it's my process, and it's self-justifying.
I'm just realizing that I've referred to my process, which is certainly not one of become famous or have a constant gallery presence, is probably an aspect of a selfishness that just says, this is very important to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I need, on a certain level, to be able to do it on my own terms.
Mm-hmm.
The teaching part then fulfills, fortunately, a very significant other part of who I am. Obviously, it's nice to have somebody respond positively to what I do, but that's a lot of, I don't know if it's heavy stuff, but it's very real.
Mm-hmm.
Bob, we've talked about the importance to you of teaching, and we now have another guest at the table, Guy Rathbun.
I'm a guest?
No.
Oh.
What is he, Steve?
He's an honored guest.
Yeah.
That'll teach you.
Well, thank you, Chris.
When I mentioned to Guy that Stephen and I would be interviewing you, and he started to reminisce. So I think it would be fun to have the two of you start where you picked up your acquaintance. So what year was that?
I'm going to say 1973, and you might call me a returning student. Just to put perspective on this, since we can't see faces, Bob was a younger teacher, and I was an older student. Okay.
Very good. And by the way, before we get involved in this, I want everyone to know I taught Guy everything he knows. His entire success is due to those early... Actually, if I remember correctly, and Guy, you please correct me. By the way, I love Guy's voice. Every time I hear him on KCBX and so on, that velvety, avuncular, trusting voice is amazing. And it was always there, right? But anyway, my recollection, Guy, is that you were in a mixed media class that I taught.
That was the second semester I was in one of your classes.
Yes, but another person who was in that class was Bill Morum.
Yes.
And Bill Morum also, I taught him everything he knows. And there's a theme here going.
You
see, if I was a little reticent about my art, you can see I'm not that way about my teaching. But anyway, that is a wonderful memory because it shows you how primal and primitive that class was, because we used to do things like reel-to-reel tapes. We used to create slides out of transparencies.
Just threw mine away.
You just threw yours away, your collection of slides from that?
Yes.
Oh, my God, the Smithsonian would have won.
2 months ago.
It was such a fun class. And in fact, getting into my teaching career, I many times had to learn something really quickly because I'm not a media person. I was interested in media and theory. I was a McLuhan-esque. That's how I approached my art appreciation. These guys were great. They're older students. I mean, remember, I have a background in public high school, and those people deserve medals. It is. I would love some of our Republican critiques of public education to take my daughter's high school class in Ventura for a week. I would love to see Mitt Romney teach that class. He would be running out screaming. But anyway, to actually get to the community college and to have middle-aged students, returning students from the Vietnam War, just appreciative to be there and the chance to earn credit and to do things. It was wonderful. And Guy was there when we had to step aside from the cow flops to get from one building to another. But it was great fun.
Okay, Guy, I'm going to put you on the spot because you did tell me a story a week ago.
Yes.
It's a story on you, Bob.
Has the statute of limitations.
Well, we'll see. Remember, we can edit.
Well, one of my favorite memories, and I think I've expressed this to Bob before, in my years of college, I went on beyond Bob's class, even though by the time I was through with Bob's class, I didn't need another class. But I went on, and I mean this quite seriously. Like I say, I think I told Bob this. In all of my years, he was one of three who held that level of being an exceptional professor. I mean, he did it with a genuine sense of love for teaching, a knowledge of his subject, and even more importantly, he got into what he was teaching. I mean, he became what he was teaching. And so when I heard that Krissa would be interviewing you, Bob, I said, I have to tell you this story. And I told it to her, and she said, do you think you'd like to relate this in the show? And I said, I don't know if Bob would appreciate it.
Yeah. Let's see what happens.
You don't know the story?
I don't think so.
Oh, Okay.
That way I can have deniability. So go ahead.
Before we hear the story, I want to let you know that you're listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio. Stephen and my guest today is Bob Pelfrey, artist and retired Cuesta College art professor. Joining us in the conversation is Guy Rathbun, currently an independent radio producer. Okay, so what's the story?
Well, got into class for the early movies. You wanted to show us the early movies, and some of the students there had no idea what silent movies were. And so the movie we were going to see was the original uncut version of King Kong. Okay. Uncut because there's this one really suggestive scene in there where it's obvious that King Kong has mad lust for Fay Wray. Not just a love interest. Mm-hmm. It was pure lust. And while this tiny woman is in his massive paw, he starts removing her already diaphanous outfit, piece by piece. And his expressions, these mechanical expressions, come on to this monster, gorilla, that are unmistakably funny.
Lecherous.
Lecherously funny. Laughter started coming from the back of the room, and it increased. And we turn around and look in the back, and there's Bob laughing so hard, so genuinely, that we all started laughing, and then tears were running down his face. He put his head on the desk like, I can't handle this. And it's just so memorable.
Oh, God.
And that, just, to me, told the story of who you are. You love what you do.
Well, I also think it shows something else. I'm sure the reason I was laughing so much is that it was the wrong reel, right? Because it sounds like a film that I probably would have decided maybe this isn't the best film to show, you know, because it sounds like a...
No!
But
It was the unexpurgated portion.
Of course it was.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't think there was a Hayes office back then, but
they
pulled it. Someone pulled that and said, you cannot show that to the public.
The thing I do remember showing in that class was Bambi Meets Godzilla or something.
I love that short.
Has made its rounds and so on. So I showed all kinds of stuff, Guy. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I sometimes surprise myself.
We were talking last week about Bob's enjoyment of making connections for students with history, with whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Besides King Kong, do you have memories of how the parts were put together?
The parts of how King Kong came about?
No, just...
This can't be an episode.
We cannot go there.
No, I hope not. We cannot go there.
You wish to rephrase that?
No.
Oh.
You want to ask this question?
See, here we go again.
Yeah.
It sounds like the original story.
I think so.
It's even more dangerous in my hands. So it's...
Sure. Okay. My experience with art history classes was not good. They tended to bore me. They tended to required that I make a whole lot of notes about stuff that somehow that was what was going to be tested. Could I remember the name and the date? And the worst one was a 1 o'clock class gone.
Nap time.
I've had a couple of good experiences, but I keep wishing I had had more. So, Guy, what kept you awake in Bob's class?
Actually, I'm really interested. Bob and I have never had any personal conversations.
No, about.
But I'm not surprised in coming into this interview hearing that he does dream journaling and work. His work is from his dreams. It doesn't surprise me at all, because what kept me alert in that class was that Bob wasn't looking for us to remember dates. In fact, I don't recall he even cared if we got the spelling of Botticelli correct. That wasn't the point. The point was to see inside the art. And so if there was an abstraction inside a 15th century piece of art, Bob brought it out. And he showed us that this elongated skull at the bottom of the painting has depth of meaning that we may never understand. But here is possibly what it means. And I hung on. I'm serious.
That's a good example.
I said, ah, I would never, ever in my wildest dreams seen this piece of work this way. So, yeah, that kept me alert.
Well, I can give a little follow-up to that, because that is how I would like to be remembered in terms of art history. I refused, even when we get into the digital, you can put all kinds of text with paintings. Mm-hmm. And let's take St. Francis in Ecstasy, which mm-hmm. to me is one of the 10 great paintings for me. Everyone agrees it is, all right? But I want people to look at that painting with no text, no titles, to distract them from just looking at the painting. Then at some point, you turn the lights on something and you give them some notes, or you pass out a handout and you tell them what you want them to remember. Mm-hmm. But while a painting is on the screen, I think the impact of the painting is paramount, including that wonderful Holbein you're talking about with the skull, the French ambassadors,
yes.
Which is so fascinating.
As I recall, and he had a way of teaching that felt like it was more involved for me as a student. And I think it's called the Socratic method, although not precisely along those lines. Bob would ask us what we see here. You'd turn around and say, what do you see? And so eventually, as we started coming out of our cocoons of being trapped inside what we thought was authority to subordinate, we started talking about it. And the livelier the class got because of the discussions, the more that came out.
How big were those classes?
You know, the art history would be 35 or 40, but the studio classes, including the infamous, you know, Bill Morham, Guy Rathbun, and I won't mention some of the other names on wanted posters, we might have 12 students. So we would show up and we'd get whatever level of technology we're working on that media class, and we'd have a very small class. It was just wonderful that way. But the lecture courses, we didn't have a big forum at all. So the biggest class would be 35 or 40. It was really a luxury. I'll give you an example of how those funky Quonset huts were great. But there's an effect called the camera obscura, where you have a pinhole camera and an outside view is projected upside down inside. Well, I noticed in one of the rooms I taught, one spring morning, I looked up and I realized it was this long, narrow band. And I realized, my God, that's a slightly extended image of the outside. There was a knothole. And so I had so much fun. I would wait for that point in the semester when we talk about the camera obscura and the invention of photography. Leonardo da Vinci actually invented one. And I would say, by the way, has anyone noticed the camera obscura in this room? And, of course, that's when I would come off like the genius, right?
Yeah. Saying,
just look at the rim, that image up there, and you see that person coming towards the door. She'll walk in a minute, and she's upside down, of course, mm-hmm. and a woman walks in the room. So those are wonderful moments.
Oh, yes.
And with new buildings, you're never going to get a camera obscura demo simply because the funky wood was rotten.
Yeah. Yeah. Those were some good memories.
Oh, yeah.
It really was.
Oh, yeah.
People laugh when they see the pictures of those barracks, but there were experiences there that made it very worthwhile.
When I was at Cal Poly in 76, 77, we used to have the ceramics classes in what we called then the cardboard jungle, which is where the Kennedy Library is now, and it was the same type of thing. It was World War II leftover buildings, and they were falling apart. But that's what they gave you.
Roger Bailey's office was his closet. Mm-hmm. Literally a closet, and he somehow jammed a desk in there so he could close the door so the desk was secured, but his chair would be outside mm-hmm. his office.
Right. Yours was kind of a cloakroom or something.
It was a wooden door that opened up to a little back room, a large closet. Perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I'm going back to the statement about not needing to know all the spellings or all the dates. Still, probably my best art history, art appreciation course, which was in high school. And that teacher did very much the same thing. And her hope was that we could know a basic time period. It was Picasso here and somebody else, whatever. And the LA County Museum had just opened up its brand new facility on Wilshire, and we went on a field trip. My museum exposure had mostly been in Chicago on train layovers when my family would cross the country. Mm-hmm. And as a 5, 6, 7-year-old, bored, silly, got off the elevator in the L.A. County Museum and looked across and went, I know who did that. It was a Modigliani painting.
Yeah.
It was a really exciting moment. Very fortunate students that you've been having all these years. I know, Guy, your love of history, so it seems that that connection and being able to connect dots would have definitely been an appeal.
Definitely, but you know, interesting, before I got to Cuesta College, I wasn't interested in history. Yeah. Is that odd? Because it was a case of a whole bunch of wooden people mm-hmm. moving around. I was in one class. He would look at the podium and say whatever he had to say, and he'd say, that happened in 1747. And then he would look up and say, write that down. And then, bong, right back to the podium, not even look at the students.
Classic.
And, yeah, I couldn't take that. But I got into Bob's class, and his characters were alive. They were living, breathing people. And that's a big, big difference. Never had a teacher bring these people to life. So they were just uninteresting to me.
One of the artworks that I found really fascinating that accomplished what you said, you were applying the artist to their period, and what they did was Judy Chicago's Dinner Party.
Oh, wow.
It was a fantastic work, but yes. Each of those place settings was done in the style of when that person was alive. And I remember reading about it thinking, this is so much more than art. You know, this is relating art to when it was created and how it was created and the people who lived at that time. And that really resonated with me.
I agree. In fact, that seeing that piece, I mean, there's a great example because Chris was talking about the, and I did too, the slide. Then you go to the reality, how it can be just overwhelming despite your expectation. And very irritated at Judy Chicago because you had to wait in line. Only a certain number could go in. And I said, what is this, church? When I went in, I didn't want to be pushed. I didn't want to have tons of people over my shoulder. I stopped at each plate, and that was a fabulous experience of art. And she was correct to say, this is how I want people to see, mm-hmm. To experience mm-hmm. this piece. Not only is it so significant at its cultural moment, it's set up like a Eucharist or like a, you know, a Last Supper type thing. And to see it slightly ritually really forces you to confront each plate, and then you really experience the presence that's evoked by each plate.
Yeah.
It's a marvelous thing.
You were teaching an art appreciation and then even some of these media-type classes. Mm-hmm. Were you also doing more conventional art history?
Yes. In fact,
and what kind of time frame did that cover?
Well, the conventional, we had 4 art history courses. Barry has always kept up the non-Western. And then I would teach ancient and then Renaissance to modern. And Chet would often teach the 20th century. So we had art history, which is, you know, historical, chronological, and data-driven. And then we had art appreciation, which is a one-semester course, the only art course presumably they'll take, because art majors have to take art history. And so you try to get as much as you can in one semester, knowing that that's going to be it. That's their whole college exposure to art. And so I did a mixture of art history and other subjects that I felt were intriguing enough or interesting enough to throw in, including television. I know that I was one of the earliest art instructors to insist that television commercials, much as we despise them, are an art form in our culture. And so I would always show a couple of lectures just on television commercials. Television in general mm-hmm. was a component of my art appreciation approach, because if the visual images that influence behavior is one definition of art of many, but it, certainly Chartres Cathedral was a tremendous propaganda mm-hmm. vehicle for the political religious order of the Middle Ages. Television itself reinforces everything about our value system and our political system, and mostly capitalism. Mm-hmm. So I worked that in too and tried to compare the television environment to the, say, the cathedral environment or the Roman, the city of Rome as a propaganda complex. I mean, Rome was unbelievably spectacular.
Seems that current day now we're preoccupied with the assessment process and the test. How did you structure exams so that you could get a sense if people were getting what you hoped that they were?
I know I couldn't teach high school with the emphasis on testing and statewide standards and things that take up, mostly because they take up so much time and people teach for the test, which I think is self-destructive. I probably gave 10 or 15 tests during the semester and a combination of journal where they could write their appreciation of something. They had to read the textbook and they had to be there for the lectures. And then I took attendance. Some of them said it was like high school, and I said, deal with it, because if they want to credit my course, they're going to be there. So Guy's description is right, that I was mostly interested in the aesthetic experience of art and giving them some very general ideas like what television is. But they can't just show up and say, gee, I dig your class, right? There were multiple choice tests as well as essay tests in my art appreciation. But I didn't belabor it. I didn't say they had to be able to distinguish 10 of Caravaggio's paintings and date them correctly in chronological order, which is what I was taught at UCLA, and I hated it. But they better know what the dates of Caravaggio are.
Do you remember kinds of things that you were doing in that studio class?
Oh, yes. I was interestingly enough, a Roman newscaster. We dressed in toga. You remember that? Yes. Oh, I do recall.
We had to shut Guy up, or Gaius, as we call him.
Yeah, that's Gaius. And the great part of that class is we, as students, had to be involved in it. It wasn't we were shown what Super 8 was and then move on to the next. We had to function sensibly with these pieces of equipment.
Bob, is there anything here that we haven't touched on at all that we need to make sure we do?
I think the CIA has debriefed me, and that in case I am a sleeper cell terrorist trying to keep something away, I think you guys have it all there. So I just ask you to be merciful.
Bob, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate your coming. And this is to Barry. I love talking about art. I don't see the problem.
And Guy, it's been very special having you here.
Thank you very much for the invite. Appreciate that.
Thank you both. It's been great.
You have just listened to the completion of a conversation with Bob Pelfrey, one of the three founders of Cuesta College's art department. The three have been honored with individual shows in conjunction with Cuesta College's 50th anniversary. Bob Pelfrey's show opens on October 16th and runs through November 8th. The gallery is open Monday through Friday from noon until 4 p.m. There is an artist's reception on October 18th from 4 to 7 p.m. with a presentation by Professor Pelfrey at 5:30. For the next two weekends, October 12th and 13th, and October 19th and 20th, there is the Open Studios Art Tour, a countywide display of over 230 artists opening their studios to the public. Open Studios Art Tour is sponsored by Arts Obispo. To find out about the tour, which is free to the public, visit artsobispo.org. You have been listening to Ears on Art, produced at the studios of listener-supported public radio, KCBX, in San Luis Obispo, California. This is Stephen DeLuque, and for co-host Krista Hewitt, thank you for listening.